This is Audible.
Manila Press presents
Somebody's Daughter, a memoir by Ashley C. Ford. Read for you by me, the author. For my family and my friends who feel like family. Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight also leaks between the roof planks of this ruined house. Izumi Shikibu. Ashley, I must admit that I was surprised to hear from you. I had just come in from my institutional job when one of the correctional officers brought me my mail. I thought that it was a book or newspaper that I had ordered because I hardly ever, if ever, receive any mail from anyone on the streets. Ashley, don't take this the wrong way, but come next year, I will have been incarcerated for 20 years, which means the letter that you wrote to me is the first letter that you have written me in almost 20 years. I was at a loss for words as I slowly read your letter over and over again. You are right when you say that you are a woman now and not a little girl. So I won't talk to you like you are a little girl. Instead, I will talk to you like you are a woman. However, don't misunderstand me. You will always be my little girl, not to mention my favorite girl. Why God in heaven gave you to me, only He knows. I do not deserve to have you as my daughter, but God gave you to me for a reason, and I am so grateful to be your father. Please, please, forgive me for all the pain I caused you in your life. I am going to survive prison. I am going to create a beautiful life for myself. I'm going to show you and your brother RC how much I love you with every breath I take. Ashley, your father is coming home. I cannot promise you when that will be, but I can give you my word that I am coming. Love always, Dad. Chapter 1. Just remember, you can always come home. There it was. I expected and hated when my mother said those words. 2 years before this call, I'd moved to Brooklyn from Indiana. Now I lived in Flatbush with my boyfriend, Kelly. Back home in the Midwest, our friends were building four-bedroom houses on one-acre lots with mortgages comparable to the monthly rent of our one bedroom. After living in the city for a year or two, I marveled at home features I would have called standard before I left. Features like dishwashers, in-unit laundry, and backyards. The apartment we lived in now had one of those, the dishwasher. When it ran, the second phase of the wash cycle shook the floor and walls with a deep rumble. I felt it in my feet while I paced the floor. I'd gotten up from dinner to take the call from my mother. She still lived in Fort Wayne, my hometown. We hadn't lived in the same city or the same house since I left for college 11 years earlier. She called every few weeks, I answered every other call, and we usually had a good time talking for 10 to 15 minutes. I'd taught myself to keep our phone conversations light, or as I like to think of it, complication-free, without lying. I didn't want to lie to her. I wanted to be able to talk to my mother the way I could with most other people, as myself. But she wasn't just anybody. She was my mother, so that was impossible. There were limits. We only dove into subjects that wouldn't end in arguments, which was mostly whatever would make us both laugh. When she said that thing to me, that I could always come home, part of me wanted to reply, "Mama, I love you, but I'll work myself past the white meat down to the bone and fistfight every stranger I run across on the street before we live under the same roof again." That was the hyperbolic expression of a feeling I did not allow myself to verbalize, for fear of ruining our smooth interaction. And it would have. There was no way to make it sound like a joke, because in some way, I wasn't joking. I got angry with myself for even thinking the thought because I knew it would hurt her to know it had ever been in my mind. I got mad at myself too for not saying it out loud anyway, for not caring if it hurt her, if it meant telling the truth. Before she called, Kelly and I were eating. We were lovers who lived together, trying to find out if we had would ever turn two people in love into the kind of family either of us wanted. We decorated and burrowed into our apartment, the nest, as he began to call our tight, warm space. We hung cheap framed prints on the walls, topped bookshelves with action figures and small stuffed animals. We created a barricade between our softest selves and the sharp elbows of the city surrounding us. It wasn't that we couldn't take a hit. We just weren't used to the pace. But we still believed we could figure it out. Either way, we were finally home, in our home, together. And I felt protected by our walls and the love shared there between them. In our small kitchen, I wanted to cook for everyone and anyone, which mostly ended up being Kelly. It was a developing skill, but to my surprise, I was not a disaster. It was one of the ways I was learning to soothe myself, suggested by a therapist who told me, take the time to feed yourself food that feels good and tastes good. Who better to do that for than you? It felt like exactly the kind of thing you pay someone to say to you. I still did it. Losing myself in the construction of a meal was the closest thing I had to a hobby. The night my mother called, I made pasta. I tried to prepare the food to be served hot and ready minutes after Kel walked through the door. He would have eaten my pasta at any temperature I offered it to him, but I wanted to get it right. When he closed the bookstore where he worked, he didn't get home until 9:45 p.m. at the earliest, closer to 10 if he had to count the drawer more than twice. My timing didn't always work out, but this evening I pulled it off. Our plates were piled with thick ropes of linguine and a homemade garlic tomato sauce oozing from the ends of our forks. When my phone buzzed on the counter, I'd squinted at the screen before answering. I'd been trying to spend less time holding or even looking at my phone. Kelly could walk away from his phone for half a day before remembering it existed. Engaging with various social media platforms didn't appeal to him the same way. He often asked me to put mine away, to be present with him, especially during meals. He wasn't wrong to ask, and I did not resent the request unless it embarrassed me. I knew I spent too much time on my phone, but sometimes I wished he could ignore that as well as I could. Still, I loved and wanted to be present with him. The only reason I gave a second thought to answering the phone during our meal was that my mother had worked the same job for more than 2 decades, and these days was almost always asleep by 9, if not before. Seeing her name flash across my phone screen worried me, so I picked up. "Hello, Mother," I said in a faux posh voice. It was meant to keep things as jovial as the moment could stand. Usually she would respond with her own equally posh voice, "Hello, Daughter." Then we'd both giggle and tell each other something silly or gossip or ask the question we'd called to ask. This time my mother said, "Hi, baby." And I knew this wasn't a quick gossiping call. I walked into the bedroom to be on my own. I shut the door behind me and sat on the bed. My chest was tight with anticipation for whatever she said next. I started to count my breaths the way my first therapist had taught me, but couldn't remember how long I was supposed to hold the breath or for how long I was supposed to let it out. I never thought enough about breathing until I needed to, and by then, it was too late. I've heard people describe panic as something that rises up inside them, For me, panic radiates in the threads of my muscles, bangs in the back of my skull, twists my stomach, and sets my skin on fire. It doesn't rise or fall. It spreads. Was it one of my siblings? My worst fear was that my mother called to tell me something happened to either one of my two brothers or my sister. Since high school, maybe even a little before then, I'd experienced recurring nightmares about one of them dying. Never dreamt of anything too gory, thank God. I never had to watch them die, not even in the worst iterations of my dreams. I always arrived in the aftermath, left to deal with the reality of losing them before waking and getting the chance to prove to myself my little loves were still here. My mother knew about my nightmares and had sent me back to bed many times after I burst into her room to listen to my youngest brother's heartbeat or watch my sister's back fall and rise with the deep and heavy but living breath of sleep. The dreams intensified when I left for college and again when I eventually left Indiana altogether. Her voice pulled me back to our halting conversation. She reassured me from the other end of the phone line, nobody's hurt, everybody's okay. The top half of my body collapsed with relief and I fell back onto the bed. I closed my eyes, and when that didn't shut out enough light, laid my forearm against my closed lids until the view behind them faded into purple and black, like the climax of a bruise. So what is it, Mom? I waited for her to speak and cursed what felt like dramatic pauses under my breath. We'd never found an easy way to talk about hard things, so we struggled to say anything at all in hard times. If she was calling about money, I wish she would just ask for what she needed so I could be honest about whether or not I could help, and we could be done. My mother huffed. She sensed my impatience. That I was an adult who was allowed to be frustrated with her annoyed her whether she verbalized it or not. For all the ways we chose to remain silent, communicating our displeasure never actually required words. She spoke. Your dad is getting out of prison. My breath caught between my mouth and lungs, unsure in which direction it was most needed. My heart hit the gas, rushing blood to parts of my body calling out for it, and my hands trembled. What were those breathing counts again? 6 in, 6 out? 6 in, 7 out? Was I going to cry? I touched my face with a shaking hand to be sure I hadn't already started. Nothing. My mother didn't speak, and it no longer felt like a performance. It felt right to have all that space for my words, my feelings, whether or not they decided to show up and tell me how to respond. My heartbeat traveled to every end of me, pumping, pumping, pumping through my ears. I moved my mouth enough to ask the only question presenting itself with any clarity in my mind. When? In about 2 weeks. I just found out he's coming home. She paused, and once again, I was grateful to have room for my thoughts. Are you okay? I wasn't, but I didn't want to have to keep talking about how I wasn't okay. It was a relief to know my siblings were unharmed and she hadn't done or said anything wrong. The ends of her questions lingered like she really did want to help, and I believed she did. The issue was that I'd been waiting to hear that my father was getting out of prison my entire life. And now that someone called me and said it was happening, all I could feel was how much I wanted to get off the phone. I was tempted, as I always am, to take the bait when my mother offers me empathy. Tempted by my fantastical belief that one day I will lower my walls and she will do the same. Then I end up blaming myself for not remembering to stick to the conversational paths offering the least resistance, furious at myself for veering too far into the unexplored or exiled. Or worse, I'd be drawn into her fantasy that we were already close. If my mother and I shared anything without having carefully considered it, it was this undying ember of a dream that we will someday, somehow, find ourselves reaping the bounty of a blooming mother-daughter bond, the roots of which we both refused to tend in the meantime. I told her I was okay. She didn't press me, and I offered nothing else. I wondered if maybe she didn't want my answers anyway, and the single thought was convincing enough for me to keep my mouth closed. I thanked her for telling me about my dad, told her I loved her, waited to hear it back, and hung up the phone. Dazed, I walked back to the kitchen counter and sat down beside Kelly, wanting nothing more than to be close to him. I didn't want to be touched, even as I begged myself not to cry. I laid my phone back on the counter, face down. He was still finishing his meal, but stopped eating and turned to me. My head spun with words, images, bits of conversations, music, and colors, making up a swirl of debris zipping past my face and returning seconds later, moving too quickly for me to reach out and hold on to anything long enough to make sense of the patterns they made or whatever they tried to tell me. If I'd had the option, I would have called my grandmother to tell her the news myself and hear her shout, "God is so good," as if she just put in a prayer request for this very outcome. She had been reliably religious, and though I never would be again, her exclamations of joy brought me comfort when I needed it most. I needed it now. I tried to count again, to breathe, or at least go numb enough to speak without crying. My emotions moved through me faster than I could name them. Feeling any of it felt like the beginning of losing control, and losing control felt like certain death in my body, if not my mind. If I didn't process the feeling, I wouldn't feel it. And if I didn't feel it, it couldn't kill me. "What was that about?" he asked. I picked up my fork and took a bite of my food. It was cold now. It was still good, but not perfect. I chewed, swallowed, and spoke without looking up. "My dad's getting out of prison in 2 weeks." I kept eating. Kelly quit moving and stared at me. His eyes popped open and his jaw lagged a bit before he snapped it shut again. "Well," he asked, "how does that make you feel?" "I don't know," I said. I looked down at my phone, wondering if I should call my mother back and say more or ask more. But what would I say? What questions did I have that she could answer? If I knew the right words or the right questions, I didn't trust myself to say them the right way. If I called back, even if I needed to call back, we would fight. I felt certain that was true. Then I stopped eating and, despite my own internal protests, began to cry. "Kel," I sobbed, "I really don't know how I feel." I sat on the stool, gulping air and swiping at my tears. My boyfriend watched me, sat patiently beside me, and when I lowered one of my hands into my lap, he covered it with his own. I felt like I knew my father, and I knew he felt like he knew me too. In reality, we'd spent the majority of both our lifetimes mentally constructing versions of one another we couldn't physically confirm or deny the existence of. We dreamed of one another, what we might be like long before we met. My Uncle Clarence, my father's closest brother, used to stare at me when we were in the same room. Sometimes I caught him. "You gotta excuse me," he'd smile. A smile that felt familiar and safe from the beginning. "You look just like my brother, but smaller, and with pigtails. Then he'd hug me, and we'd laugh to keep the sadness away. I always wished he'd say more about the little brother he loved, the man who left me with his face and little else. He rarely did. I didn't see Uncle Clarence that often. I kept wishing anyway. The few times I visited my father, though pleasant, bowed under the weight of our expectations. We were happy to see one another, but we could not always say the thing we wanted to say most and risk spoiling the other's dream. We never discussed them, yet somehow agreed on these terms, an unspoken pact between an emotionally desperate father and daughter, made up contracts for a shoestring bond. "That's okay, baby," my father would say when I tried to apologize on the phone for not writing. "You write me when you want to. I'll be waiting patiently and happily." He kept writing. He wrote that I was his favorite girl, I was brilliant, and I was the best daughter anyone could ever hope for. For a long time, that was all I needed. Until, of course, I needed more. Chapter 2. My oldest memory is of my younger brother, RC, eating a smashed, overripe tomato. I remember the way he grabbed at the pulpy red flesh and the way he could only hold it one way, as tightly as he possibly could. This is normal for small children who have not yet mastered their motor skills. There's no difference between holding and squeezing. They don't know any better. He didn't know any better, and neither did I. Of course, the guts of the fruit broke free into the spaces between his small fingers and made a mess on the white tray top surrounding him. By the time he opened his hand to take a bite, there were only cold strings of bright skin and small white seeds. My brother was too young to walk, but I wasn't. It was I who rooted around at the bottom of the refrigerator, found the food, and attempted to slice it for him with a butter knife. He'd been crying in his walker, the little wheels scooting back and forth across the floor as he flung himself from side to side. My mother slept so hard his wails didn't stir her. I didn't want her to wake up. I wanted her to sleep, and I wanted to help. My brother and I were 14 months apart in age, so I must have been around 3 years old. I don't remember a time before him. I was supposed to have been a miracle baby for my mother. She'd had an ovary removed as a teenager, and her doctor told her the other one didn't work. It worked enough for me, apparently. Then RC came along, and I was not a miracle anymore. I was a big sister. And to me, that was better. I loved him too much, right from the beginning. I saw my mother go to feed him each time he cried, so I thought food would make him happy. He was my best friend. I would take care of him. I rubbed his head and whispered, "Don't cry, baby. Don't cry." When I was in college, one of my therapists at the on-campus counseling center told me I shouldn't remember any of this because I was too young. He told me most people don't have memories of themselves or their experiences at 2 and 3 years old. He asked me when I started speaking. I told him that I could speak in sentences before I could walk, a fact I'd been reminded of by my grandmother every chance she got. "You couldn't walk straight for nothing. We called you Stagger Lee," she'd say, laughter ripping through her entire body, infecting anyone else in the room, even me, often at my own expense. "But you'd point at something you wanted and say, 'I want that.' I thought, 'What kind of child is this?'" She'd shake her head, recreating the same confused look she'd apparently worn all those years ago. I told him my grandmother had a tendency to oversell my childhood intellect, so I couldn't be sure if it was accurate information. He wrote it down on his notepad, and I continued to tell him my stories or what I remembered of them. My earliest memories are sunburnt Polaroids, frozen moments gone blurry at the edges and spotted all down the middle. Then, at 4, the pictures become clearer and clearer, as do the voices within them. The loudest voice belongs to my brother, before he could properly pronounce my name, calling for me. Hashi? Where are you? Where's my Hashi? My brother loved me and made it so easy to believe I was good. I was a child, unspoiled in a certain way. I didn't doubt myself. I decided and I tried. Then I'd fail and try again. Or I would succeed and go on to try something new. I was not always as afraid of the world or as nervous about the other people living in it alongside me or what they might do to me. When my life was new, I understood in my bones how little it mattered what anybody else was doing or what they thought about what I was doing. I believed my bones then. When I was 4 years old, I taught myself to lie awake until morning. I wanted the sunrise, and I only had to stay awake to have her. When children are small, our desires seem small, even if we want the sky. Anything we want seems to be only a matter of time and effort away. It's too early to imagine what's already holding you back. I'd been enraptured with a storybook about the cycle of the sun. I remember looking on in awe as my teacher outstretched her right arm, extending it as far as she could, her fingers spread for the illusion of an extra inch. Her left arm moved out and away from her body, though not as far as its opposite, still close enough to read from the book she held. It was a simple and sad attempt to describe the sheer enormity of a life-supporting star to a pre-K classroom. She said the word sunshine, and we said it back. Her eyes roamed the cramped space for something to support her lesson, a point of reference that might get this thing to click. The taupe tile floor and its matching tattered and stained square reading carpet had nothing to add. Nor did the sky, nor rain falling from overfull clouds inching down the window behind her. Still, she tried to get us to understand, to sit down, to stop talking, to want to know more about what the universe might be up to while life so far had been teaching us to be wholly consumed with ourselves. I wanted to know. I sat quietly and waited for her to continue the story of the sun. My teacher turned the second to last page, revealing the final illustration. Those massive swirls of orange, gold, yellow, and a smattering of sweet pinks left little cracks all over my heart. I gasped. I repeated the word, sunrise. And the sound opened like a spring bloom on the tip of my tongue. There are few words worthy of the wonders they describe, but sunrise sounds like it feels. A U sunken to the bottom of one's throat and an I pointing upward and onward to a warm beyond. I'm sure I'd seen a sunrise sometime before then and had maybe even heard the word before. The sky was already one of my favorite things. It told me what kind of day I might have. A sunny day usually meant being outside with family, especially RC, my brother, best friend, and favorite playmate. Sometimes our mama even played with us. Rainy days were charming too. My mother, brother, and I would sit on the couch together, small limbs draped over big ones, and watch movies. We had 4 or 5 kids' movies on VHS, and my brother learned them all by heart. Every once in a while, he would get lost in a movie, sitting, staring, and speaking every line of dialogue as the actors spoke it on screen. My mother, grown frustrated, would yell, "Shut up or I'll turn it off!" He would stop. But after sitting a while, staring a while, and forgetting why he shouldn't, he'd start to do it again. When she got tired of kid movies, my mother would put on something meant for older audiences. My brother and I would watch those too. My obsession with sunrises and sunsets was only stoked by their repeated appearances in the introductions or theme songs of some of my favorite television shows, like The Golden Girls or China Beach. I'd never noticed the sky above our home look anything like the orange and gold dreamsicle clouds in my teacher's book, but I'd seen them on TV. I knew they happened somewhere. After school that day, on the car ride back to our apartment, I decided I wanted the sunrise. I knew I couldn't have the sunrise or its colors from my own. Some things were too precious not to be shared. They just had to happen, and you just had to make sure you were there when they did. And then you were part of something with everyone else who showed up at the right time. The first night I reached for the sun, my mother was expecting company. Mom, Arcia, and I usually shared one bed in the studio, but she tucked us kids in on the couch that night. This put a huge kink in my plans. There was a window right behind the bed, but not the couch. I'd glimpsed the leftovers of the brilliant painted sky many mornings when I woke up for school, but it wasn't good enough. I'd convinced myself it would look different, more brilliant if I stayed up to watch. I wanted the real thing, and I knew I could prove myself worthy to the sky. "I want a sunrise, and so it shall be," was a natural truth in my child mind, and I did not let go. The view from the couch wouldn't do. I tried to stay up anyway, to practice for the night after. But my brother's warm legs wrapped up in mine under our blanket brought on the dense and resolve melting fog of exhaustion. My mind resisted rest, but all that closeness eventually soothed me to sleep. The next morning, I woke up to the sun already in the sky and the television playing. A commercial was running and I caught the words, "Smoking cigarettes will kill you." I rubbed the sleep out of my eyes and looked over at the pack of cigarettes sitting in my mother's black purse. She must not have known. I sat up to tell her, but she wasn't in the room. I heard noises coming from behind the closed bathroom door, letting me know she was handling private business, but I couldn't wait for her presence or permission to act. I grabbed the cigarettes from her black purse, opened the small cardboard box, and dumped each one into the trash can full of last night's dinner, which had been prepared exclusively from cans. When my mother came out of the bathroom, I told her what I'd seen about the cigarettes on TV. "They could kill you." My mother rolled her eyes at me, and at the mention of them, began looking for her cigarettes in earnest. Only then did it occur to me that she may not feel relieved I'd already thrown them out. I watched the panic sweep over her as my own followed. When we were bad, my mother hit us for it, and there was always the thought that I would die in the back of my mind. I didn't think my mother wanted to kill me on purpose. It was her eyes. My mother's rage drained the light from her eyes, and she became unrecognizable to me. There was Mama, the loving mother we knew before whatever sparked her ire, and then there was Mother, who showed up in her place. Mother felt separate, somehow apart from our otherwise happy and harmonious existence. She rose from somewhere within Mama and did the latter's dirty work. Every once in a while, my brother and I were the dirty work needing done. I sat quietly on the couch, watching my mother, trying to be very still. I knew Mama would find her cigarettes in the black trash bag eventually, a few of them ripped in half to ensure their loss. When she did, I was going to get hit, and I was already afraid of the pain. I couldn't and I wouldn't tell on myself. Self-preservation had already been imprinted upon me as a requirement. Honesty was not always the best policy. Grown-ups would tell you it was important to tell the truth, and when you did, everything would work out. But I knew this wasn't the case. There must have been a time before, a time when I'd done something bad, realized it, and told on myself. The punishment I received for the forgotten transgression must have been severe because the next time I was alone and I did something bad, it belonged only to me. I learned to carry the secrets of my badness silently and alone. There would be no more confessions from me. Whoever wanted to know how bad I could be would have to get close enough to find out, and nobody tried. My mother didn't stop searching for her cigarettes. I hoped, for a moment, she might question if she'd actually been the one to throw them away. These things happened accidentally. That would have been lucky for me. But I did not feel like a lucky child. I saw too much and suspected even more than that. I waited for what I knew would come. The day dragged on, heavy from the weight of my mounting fear. That night, I fell asleep before the sun rose again, exhausted from the nervous energy coursing through my body. I woke in a vice. I was being squeezed on all sides, and the television was too loud. There were people screaming on whatever show was playing, and I couldn't understand why my mother didn't turn it off. The voice was too close, and the vice was too strong for me to linger in the space between sleep and awake. "Ashley!" My mother's voice bellowed around me like the echoing ring of a large bell, and her hands gripped me from both sides, shaking me and repeating, "Wake up!" I came to enough to recognize who was screaming. It was not my mother. It was the mother. She'd come for me in the middle of the night, and I had been caught prone, with no place to hide all the bad I'd done. The mother pulled me from the bed, dragged me into our small kitchen, pointed one long finger, a beautiful one that sometimes belonged to my real mother, toward the open trash can. I hadn't even tried to bury the cigarettes deeper in the trash bag. They sat right on top, looking back at me, accusing me, and I accepted their blame. I was guilty. I knew this. The garbage knew this. And now, so did the mother. I went to sleep sore, but grateful once again that the mother hadn't lost control. I was hurt, but I would not die. The sunrise could still be mine. Another day. The next morning, I awoke to the mother I knew, and we both went about our day like nothing significant had happened the night before. I did not blame the mother for hurting me. It didn't feel like it wasn't my fault. Sometimes I was bad, and sometimes people were bad to me. Either way, the badness belonged where it landed. I wanted to believe this was true. That it was all in my control somehow, or in someone's control. All my fault, all my choice, all mine to have or hide or heal. I decided to pretend to be good, the kind of good that seemed to be best, the silent kind. For the whole day, through school, after school care, and most of the time home with my family, I did not speak unless spoken to. It worked. My mother said, "You're being such a good girl today." I smiled and said nothing. I was so quiet, my mother didn't notice my eyes were still open when she drifted off to sleep. She didn't notice me whispering to my shadow to keep myself awake. She didn't feel me lean over our wooden headboard in the early morning light, peel back the burgundy curtain, and greet the sunrise all by myself. The sun had risen for me alone, and turned the sky into the painted milk of a soggy bowl of leftover off-brand Lucky Charms. The soft roses and lavenders went on to burn blood orange on the underbellies of clouds. I told my shadow I wanted to keep the sun. My shadow whispered back the instructions for making a memory. I watched the light of day ascend until it hurt my eyes. Then I closed them and taught myself to remember. My mother didn't know I could do bad things and still have the sun. She didn't know I could keep my own truth and memories inside. But I knew. Chapter 3. Before my teacher showed me the bright pastels of morning light, I made friends with the dark in my grandmother's bedroom. Her soft powders and sweet lotions made the space smell more like a pastry shop than a place to rest. More than once, she had to pry her various skincare products from the hands of a grandchild as they licked, bit, or swallowed the expensive contents, enticed by scents too mouthwatering not to be edible. Something about my grandmother's room made me feel protected, and so it was the only place I didn't mind being alone. Instead of feeling closed in by the silence, I felt expanded by it, part of it, and it welcomed me unlike anything I'd known so far. When I turned out the light, nobody guessed I was in there telling myself stories, building safe places to go inside my head. They would walk right by me, never knowing I'd been there beside them in the dark. I don't remember if my grandmother's apartment was unlocked or if I knew where to find a key, but the former is most likely. I didn't turn on the lights when I walked through the door. It helped that there was still a bit of light streaming in from the windows in the kitchen and living room, which were only a few feet apart. I began to sing a song to myself, the theme to my favorite cartoon, The Little Bits. With no one to hear but my shadow, I felt safe to sing the tune without punishment. The last time I let out this song, I'd received a smack in the mouth for the favor. Eventually, the adults would realize I actually hadn't been calling anyone a little bitch, but poorly singing lyrics from the cartoon theme, as toddlers sometimes do. When they repeated this story, they laughed. But there was no fear of retribution here now, where I spun, still singing, up the stairs to my grandmother's bedroom. I flipped the light switch and stopped singing. My grandmother had betrayed me. Or that's how I felt. Her bedroom was full of toys. A small drum set, a Tonka dump truck, a baby doll, a board game whose name I couldn't read to repeat or save inside a memory. There were a few more piled under the initial set of toys I saw, and even more beneath those. She had all those toys, so many things I wanted, and she hadn't been sharing them with me. With me! After RC, my grandmother was my best friend. For my mother, she was a second parent since my father was in jail. Even when my mother, brother, and I were alone, our unit felt incomplete without Grandma Billy. How could she keep this from me? The same woman who told my mother, "Sometimes I feel so close to Ashley, it's like I gave birth to her myself." I knew from hearing the story over and over, my mother had responded, "Well, you didn't." A distant understanding nudged me, and I knew it was time to leave. I was not supposed to be seeing these toys, even if I didn't know why. I'd hoped to snatch a little time alone and spend it singing, spinning, and whispering to my shadow. Instead, I'd done another bad thing. This would be a secret bad thing, too. That way, nobody had to get hurt. Nobody had to tell their secrets. Weeks later, I'd forgotten all about my grandmother's room and the treasure it held. The fear of getting found out for being there outweighed any desire to reach out to a grown-up with my follow-up questions. I would forget the toys. I would forget the feelings. I would stop sneaking into places I didn't belong. I didn't want to get into trouble, but that feeling was outweighed by the much closer and nagging fear I'd cross some door into a place I wouldn't be able to come back from. The holiday season brought all the distraction I needed. My brother and I would sleep under the Christmas tree lights, eyes closed, watching the backs of our eyelids turn blue, orange, red, and purple, calling out the colors as they appeared to us. At least once, our mother would wrap us in blankets in the back seat of the car with snacks and drinks, and we'd drive off into a snowy night. She wouldn't say where we were going, but inevitably, we would end up heading north. With the downtown of Fort Wayne nearly abandoned, my mother would weave the car down one-way streets, heading west, then east, featuring display after display of historical holiday cheer. Our official tour began at the bread factory, where a mechanical wheel of never-ending sliced bread actually never stopped slicing. And the smell of hot flour, sugar, and yeast entwined itself with Christmas. The factory would be decorated with blinking lights, cascading from just below the perpetually spinning bread wheel to what I assumed was the ground beneath us. We'd pass Santa and his reindeer, bigger than life and all lit up on the side of PNC Bank, and he would wink at me. I knew it was a trick of the light, but I winked back just in case the real Santa might know that I didn't. The drive was nearly over when we got to the bright green wreath on the plaza, but this was also the spot where my mom would park and let us out. All three of us would jump toward the wreath that was mounted much too high for any person to reach. We didn't think we could reach it either, but it didn't stop us from trying. My mother threw snowballs at us, and we retaliated until the green lights of the display reflected in the shimmering melted snow in our hair. As we walked back to the car, my body felt warmer than the cold should have allowed, but inside I felt a sadness from somewhere before, somewhere I couldn't remember, but was certain I hadn't forgotten. On Christmas morning, we woke to a tree lousy with gifts. Some wrapped and at least one too big for wrapping. My brother and I jumped out of bed and raced toward the tree, but I stopped just short of my brother and my mother's feet, waiting for the presents to be handed out, like my mother told us would happen. I stood still, my eyes focusing, unfocusing, and focusing again on what I suddenly recognized as a small drum set. My mother did not notice my hesitation before I slid into the spot below her, beside my brother. As excited as we were for our gifts, she may have been even more anxious for us to tear her careful wrapping asunder and lay our glad eyes on the material fruits of her labor. My mother handed my brother a box double the size of his head, covered in what looked like little hand-drawn Christmas trees and ornaments. The tree. That was all that had been missing in my grandmother's room. If all those toys had been wrapped and under a tree, they would be just like the presents we were opening now. My secret badness came back to bite, and what it had taken left me sadder than I knew what to do with. In the time it took my brother to rip the tree-patterned paper separating him from his brand new yellow Tonka dump truck, I realized Santa Claus wasn't real. I'd found this secret place inside to shield my bad self, the part that chose not to tell the truth. But it had never occurred to me everyone might have a secret bad self. A self that didn't tell the truth because it had learned the same lessons I'd learned and knew the quiet and the dark could be good places to hide from screams and slaps. Something cracked. And now, I didn't get to delight in the magic, but instead had to pretend, like the adults. I'd done it to myself. In search of my shadow, I'd lost some of my childish wonder and hadn't realized it was a no-trade deal. I wanted to cry. I started to cry. Then I looked at RC, his big eyes widening, smiling like the sun itself, turning his new truck in his hands over and over. He looked up at me, expecting me to engage in this joyous moment with as much enthusiasm as we'd shared only moments ago. I threw my arms open, stretching through my fingers, and turned to the best, most happiest part of my life, my brother.
RC, look! Look what Santa brought us!
I didn't know if this counted as a lie. Another bad thing to add to the record I'd already begun to keep of my transgressions, big or small. I knew my brother was happy with his truck, happy believing that Santa thought we were good enough to be worthy of such a rare bounty. For my brother and myself, I put on a show. I already knew I wasn't that kind of good. In my young mind, I'd already proven it. Chapter 4. One day, during a family nap on the couch, wrapped in my mother's and brother's arms and legs, I half woke from a dream and thought I saw a man in the corner of the room. I blinked. Still there.
"Go away,"
I whispered. He did not go away. I was afraid of him, and as soon as I realized it, he reached toward me and cut my face. I woke up with the warmth and pressure of my family's bodies still slumbering around me. The man was gone, a dream. My body flooded with relief and I rolled over a bit, rearranging for comfort. I felt something sticky on my face. I wiped my cheek with the back of my hand and felt the small, hot line of blood before I saw my stained knuckles. It scared me so much, I closed my eyes and pretended to sleep until my mother awakened. I didn't show her my face, waiting for her to notice instead, which only took seconds after opening her eyes. She said I must have scratched myself in my sleep. She cleaned it and kissed it and said it might leave a scar. When I showed it to my grandmother, I told her about the man in my dream, expecting her to soothe me, to tell me dreams weren't real and nightmares wouldn't always come for me when I closed my eyes. "Did you speak to him?" she demanded. Telling me what I'd seen or dreamed, I wasn't sure anymore. Had probably been a demon. "No," I insisted. It came out with all the unnecessary aggression of a child's lie. But her face and tone told me no was the only correct answer to her question. The memory of whispering, "Go away," clung to my consciousness, wrapped in fear. My grandmother said demons find all kinds of ways to show up in your life, even in your dreams, and that their job was to trick me and everybody else into doing something wrong. Enemies, she called them. Don't ever speak to them. That's how they get inside you. Of course, I had a lot of questions about how this all worked. Demons wanted to trick me into speaking to them so they could get inside me and do what? And why me? I was just a kid. That's when she explained that right now I was practicing being a good woman by being a good girl. However, when I turned 12 years old, every bad or wrong action I made would officially count against me in the eyes of God. She told me that God was watching me, but so were the demons, and they were waiting to see who I would decide to become, following the righteous or unholy breadcrumbs I'd left behind over the first 12 years of my life. According to my grandmother, when I turned 12 years old, I would have agency. My sins would no longer be a failure on the part of my parents, but an individual choice to eschew God and please the devil. Demons, she said. If they think you're weak enough, will begin to force you to do things you can't even remember doing. That's probably why I believed my cousins when they told me I'd burned down our first apartment. The apartment had burned, that much was true. Baby photos, clothes, and other props in the everyday life of a single mother of two went up in flames. But I don't remember any of that. I remember the story my cousins told me, that I had been touching things I shouldn't have, plugging them in, turning them up, and forgetting about them. They told me everything I loved except my family was now ash and dust, and I accepted the blame. I thought it must have been me. Who else would have spoken to a demon? We moved into a triplex where my grandmother lived in the back one-bedroom apartment. Her front door was only 3 or 4 feet from our back door, and our little family visited her often. My mother's youngest sister, her husband, and their two children lived in the third apartment, the two-bedroom above us. We didn't visit them quite as much, but that was mostly because we could all almost always be found at Grandma's. I rolled around with my cousins in the grass behind our shared home at all hours of the day, staring into the sky, trying to make them laugh. We were all happiest together. My grandmother was the first person I remember asking about my father. I was sitting on her bed while she sat beside me, folding clothes and separating her dry cleaning. She owned so many brightly colored animal print or even sequin dresses that they overflowed from her closet, one or two spilling to the floor each time she tried to make room for new arrivals. Her closet was also full of matching shoes and bags that I'd only ever seen her wear into a church for Sunday service, a holiday concert, wedding, or funeral. According to her, these weren't even her best looks. When I was young, woo, her eyes would complete a full animated roll from one end of the bedroom to the other. I'm telling you, when I'd go out to listen to music and dance, I would be dressed down. In her poorly lit walk-in closet, my budding curiosity blossomed. Shoeboxes were stacked in the corner, but when opened, one might find anything from letters I couldn't read to never-worn costume jewelry my grandmother would thank me for finding. There were also some filled with old family photographs, and I riffled through them often. It was easy for me to form a picture of my grandmother as a younger woman than she was as she stood before me. 47 years old, she had been divorced twice, raised 5 girls, and was already grandma to 9 children with the 10th on the way in the apartment directly above her own. I walked over to her closet and pulled my favorite photos from a green shoebox in the corner. I spread them out before me, with a few I hadn't seen displayed so I could ask questions about them. I was always asking questions, and she was one of the few adults who didn't ever tell me to stop. In one old photo, my grandmother sat on the corner of a bed in what looked to be a hotel room. The same unmistakable gap-toothed smile spread across her face while she leaned back onto the bed, exposing an ample portion of her thigh through a sky-reaching slit in the fitted gown. This one was my second favorite. It had so many things I loved. Grandma, a pretty dress, but the best thing was her hair. My grandmother's afro was big and round and formed a halo around her beaming face, accented by barely there arched eyebrows. She liked to look her best and always had. I'd never found a photo of her looking sloppy, a descriptor she despised in others. To my grandmother, there were few things worse than being sloppy. She saw no excuse for the lack of control, even and especially in herself. In my mind, my grandmother had come into the world a beautiful woman and had continued to be beautiful because that's what she wanted to do. She chose the right clothes, hairstyles, shoes, and furniture. I don't know how. She just knew. My grandmother even talked to God the right way. When we went to church together and the pastor invited the congregation to speak praise unto the Lord, my throat would tighten and my lips would go numb. There were a number of hymns I already knew by heart, but when I tried speaking in tongues on my own, even in the safety of a bathroom with a locked door, I felt embarrassed watching myself in the mirror. My grandmother was not embarrassed. When the pastor called forward, she would break into the same garbled line. I could tell from the others in church that the language was sacred. After one such time, I asked her what she was saying when she spoke that way. "You won't understand," she told me. "It's the way God taught me to speak to him. It's a special language between us. It will never sound right to you." Once, I pretended to know. After a particularly rowdy and emotional Sunday sermon from her then pastor, my grandmother worked herself up enough to grab my hand and walk us both up to the altar. As I got closer to the pulpit, I could see the pastor touching the foreheads of other church members, praying for them, and then, it seemed, forcefully pushing them to the ground. Ushers, men and women in black clothes and white gloves, rushed to cover the now writhing worshipers with short red blankets. The people on the ground laughed and cried at the same time. I thought they looked silly and a little scary. My grandmother and I stood in line, and when the pastor knocked her to the ground, I wanted to hit him back. But then I heard her laughing. My grandmother, like all the other red worms, wriggled on the ground, filled with the incomparable joy of her Holy Spirit. When I began to laugh, an usher gently pulled me to the ground beside her and covered me in a blanket of my own. I wondered how many people I knew had already learned how to talk with God, and I wondered why God would only give a person one thing to say to him. Wouldn't that get boring? Church was already boring enough. Still, no one else talked about him as much as my grandmother, which caused me to think she must be closest to him. She would know how he preferred to be spoken to. She always knew. Sometimes my mother spoke about God, and so did a few of my aunts and adult family friends, often to tell me how my behavior displeased him. No one else spoke to him the way my grandmother did, as far as I knew. But I didn't know all of the grown-ups. We came from such a big family and had so many close family friends, I felt like I was always meeting someone new who my mother introduced with familiarity and love. Even if I'd never known them before, it felt like I'd forgotten them and had to be reminded. The photos in my grandmother's closet held numerous stories about family I didn't know, and in some cases would never know. I liked the stories anyway. I laid the photo of my grandmother in the dress back down on the bed and picked up one I hadn't seen before. In the bottom of the photo, my brother and I are holding one another in a big hug and smiling toward the camera. Our smiles are big and exaggerated, and I can tell we've been told to put them on. The real joy is in our embrace, while the setting around us is drab. The edges of the backdrop we're standing in front of are rolling up in the corners, and the photographer didn't think or care to cut them out. The floor is made of checkered tile, and the chairs surrounding us are pea green, faded with varying degrees of age and wear. Above us, our mother smiles with her eyes closed into the same camera. She is holding and being held by a man who shares a face with my brother. The man's eyes are happy. I know I'm supposed to know who he is, but I don't. Without hesitation, I turned to my grandmother, held the photo up to her face, and asked, "Who is this man?" My grandmother stopped sorting her clothes and looked up at the photo. "Girl," she almost barked the word, the end softening into laughter. She took the photo from my hands and held it closer to her face. Her glasses slipped down the bridge of her nose, landing on the rounded tip. She allowed them to rest there while she scanned the picture, pressing her lips together and shaking her head until handing the photo back to me. "Damn shame you don't recognize your own daddy." I can't remember a time before I knew my father was incarcerated or just in jail, as I said, for the first decade of my life. But I remember a time when he, the fact of his existence, was a hard memory to hold on to. I saw my mother, grandmother, and brother every day. The sun greeted me each morning, whether I'd watched it rise or not. I prayed to God each night like I'd been told. I could count my ABCs, sing along to the radio, and even remember how to tie my shoes if I practiced enough. These things were not hard to remember. But my father, far away, gone without an explanation, would fade away into the background of my 4-year-old everyday life until I'd forgotten he'd ever been part of it at all. But before he went to jail,